A Chance Encounter inspires a novel about a girl, a prophecy, and an empire.
I was sort of wandering around all these antique stores, and I went into one that was really more of a junk shop than an antique store. It was kind of narrow and dusty, and at the back of the shop, in this crystal punch bowl, was a picture of a little girl, and she just had the most wise, self-possessed look in her eyes. And I knew as soon as I saw this picture, as soon as we made eye contact across the centuries, that this was the protagonist. And it all kind of clicked in that moment, and I realized that the novel would be set in Istanbul.
That's Michael David Lucas talking about his novel, The Oracle of Istanbul. It's about a young girl of astonishing talents who changes the course of the Ottoman Empire. And four college friends from Bombay, India, reconnect decades later when one of them falls gravely ill and find their lives profoundly changed.
The ultimate result is one of liberation, but I think the bulk of the novel deals with the process that leads to that degree of liberation. Towards the very end of the novel, Nishtha actually has a line where she says something like, she has used Armaiti's illness as a ladder to climb out of the dark pit of her own life.
That's novelist Triti Umrigard talking about her latest book of fiction, The World We Found. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Michael David Lucas's novel, The Oracle of Istanbul, takes us back to the waning years of the Ottoman Empire. It's a story of a remarkable little girl, 8-year-old prodigy Eleonora Cohen, who finds herself at the fulcrum of history, lever in hand. A motherless Jewish immigrant, she becomes advisor to the last sultan, and therein lies a tale that juxtaposes magic with reality, fable with history. The Oracle of Istanbul is Michael David Lucas's first novel. I spoke to him in February of 2011, just around the time of the Arab Spring. Michael David Lucas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here.
I loved The Oracle of Istanbul. This was a totally fun novel to read. I wanted to ask you, now this is your debut novel, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkably accomplished, I think, for a debut novel, and it's in a kind of unusual style, in a way. I've seen you call it historical fabulism. Could you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, a lot of people, when they read the book or when they read sort of earlier drafts of the book, they would always reference Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and they would always sort of talk about magical realism. And there's definitely an element of magic to my book. And I love Marquez, but he wasn't really someone who I looked to for guidance when I was writing the book. I more looked to folks like Günter Grass or José Saramago or Italo Calvino a little bit, people who use history as this sort of as a subject, but add a little bit of magic into the mix. And so I felt like I needed to come up with another word to describe what I was doing. And so I thought historical fabulism worked pretty well. Hasn't quite caught on, but, you know, give it some time.
I like it. Now, this is the story of a young Jewish girl, a prodigy, in the Ottoman Empire in the year 1877 is when most of the action takes place. Tell us about this young girl. Tell us about Eleonora Cohen.
She is a preternaturally intelligent little girl. She's really sharp. She loves reading, and there's something a little bit magical about her. Both in terms of her calmness and her wisdom, but also in terms of how the natural world reacts to her. There's a flock of hoopoes that follow her around. They come into the town at the moment that she's born, and they follow her around.
And what are hoopoes for those of our listeners who would have included myself at one time who don't know what hoopoes are?
A hoopoe is this really strange bird that I think think is from the Middle East mostly, maybe Europe or in Africa too. But it's got a kind of crown, and it's got this little, I guess, hooked nose kind of, and it just looks very weird. And they're really important in the sort of mythology of the Middle East. It was said that a hoopoe brought word of the Queen of Sheba to King Solomon, I think it was. And now, just a couple of years ago, they were chosen as the state bird of Israel. So it's this bird that looks very strange and has all these sort of magical associations in the region.
So a flock of them appears at her birth, and they stick with her.
Yeah, they follow her throughout pretty much the whole book.
And there are other portents and signs at her birth.
Yeah, her birth is attended by a pair of Tartar midwives that kind of show up, and they reference this prophecy. A sea of horses, the North Star in alignment, you know, all these sort of signs that they had read. And I wanted to leave it open to question whether the prophecy that they're referencing is actually being fulfilled by Eleonora. That's a question that sort of I wanted to haunt the book. And so I'm not going to come down either way whether it actually is fulfilled by Eleonora's birth or not. But there's definitely these people who believe that, you know, she has this sort of prophetic role to play.
And what caused you or what drew you to put the setting of this book in the Ottoman Empire at this time, much less having the protagonist be a young girl in a very, misogynist society, really?
I was living in Tunisia right after I graduated from college, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. I was studying Arabic. I was there through a Rotary ambassadorial scholarship, and so I was studying Arabic and applying to MFA programs and just kind of flailing around, really. And I just finished my last application to MFA programs, and I'd gone on a run through the outskirts of Tunis. And this idea of almost like a picture of a little girl playing backgammon with two older men just kind of came to me. And I didn't know where she lived or when she lived or who she was or really anything except that this was the protagonist of the novel that I wanted to write. And so I was in Tunisia for a couple more months and kind of trying to figure out for a while. She was in Mamluk Cairo, and then she was, you know, in during the Fatimid period. And so I was kind of trying to figure out where and when to place the book. All I really had was her. And so I left Tunisia. My year was up, and I was going to go to Uzbekistan to visit my ex-girlfriend, who was doing the Peace Corps there. And through a series of miscommunications and cross signals, I ended up being deported because I didn't have the right visa. And so I got sent back to Istanbul, which is where I transferred through. And I ended up with 10 days by myself in Istanbul with nothing really to do. And this was compounded by the fact that I had already been there and already visited all the mosques and the palaces and everything like that. So I just kind of wandered around the city, and I really fell in love with it during that time. On the third or fourth day, I went to a neighborhood called Çukurcuma, which is the setting of Orhan Pamuk's novel, The Museum of Innocence. And Çukurcuma is famous for its antique stores. And so I was sort of wandering around all these antique stores, and I went into one that was really more of a junk shop than an antique store. It was kind of narrow and dusty, and at the back of the shop, in this crystal punch bowl, was a picture of a little girl. And she just had the most wise, self-possessed look in her eyes. And I knew as soon as I saw this picture, as soon as we kind of made eye contact across the centuries, that that this was the protagonist that I had seen. And it all kind of clicked in that moment, and I realized that the novel would be set in Istanbul. it would be set in the 1880s, which is when this picture was taken, and also happens to be the end of the Ottoman Empire. And I went home and spent the rest of that night writing, and 7 years later, I have the book.
So you went to Tunisia, and of course, Tunisia has been much in the news. This story is about the end of a great empire, the Ottoman Empire, and in some ways it's resonant possibly with the end of the American Empire. What are some of your thoughts on what's happening in Tunisia and the end of those regimes there? I mean, do you find a resonance between the book that you wrote and some current events?
Yeah, I actually studied abroad in Egypt, too, and so the last couple months have been really remarkable to watch. It's, you know, the Middle East is not a region that usually gives us good news. It's not a place that gives us, in the past, you know, 10 or 15 years at least, much hope. And it's been so amazing to see these places that I lived. And, you know, literally the places I went to school, I went to school, you know, 20 meters from Tahrir Square. And in Tunisia, I remember watching, you know, some news footage, and there was the rotisserie chicken restaurant that I used to go to. And so it's really remarkable to watch, and especially because, you know, when I was living in Egypt, and especially in Tunisia, the sense of political repression was really palpable. I remember one time I had just met this guy, and we were kind of becoming friends, and we were walking down the street going to, like, a tea shop or something like that, and I noticed a poster of the former president, now Ben Ali, and, you know, the streets are plastered. You know, it's classic sort of dictator situation. The streets were plastered with this guy's face, but it was usually one or two official portraits, and this one was a little bit different. It was like he was wearing sunglasses or he was skiing or something like that. And so I pointed it out to my friend, and my friend didn't say anything. And so I thought that maybe I'd used the wrong word in Arabic, or he just didn't hear me or something. So I repeated it, and I pointed more sort of demonstrably, and he took my collar and he whispered in my ear, "We don't talk about that on the street."
Wow.
And so just not wanting to say the president's name on the street, that really struck me.
Hmm. And so in the time that you talk about in your book, in the Oracle of Stamboul, and Stamboul was the old name for Istanbul?
It's the name in Russian. It's the name, I think, in Arabic. And it's an old British name, too. A lot of Orientalist British, you know, spy novels or travelogues will talk about Stamboul. And okay. I wanted to make a tiny separation between the Istanbul that exists in our world and the Stamboul that exists in the world of the book. I didn't want to be, you know, 100% tied to the geography and the history of the city of Istanbul, and I thought that making a little bit of a different name would allow me that separation.
Kind of an alternate reality, an alternate universe.
Yeah.
So in this novel here, this is a time of also obviously an autocratic or dictatorial regime, and plotting against it. There's all kinds of intrigue in this. Without giving away, you know, too much of the plot, what can you tell us about Eleanor Cohen at the age of 8 and her involvement in the political life of this nation?
Maybe I can tell you about she becomes an advisor to the Sultan. I can tell you that. That's on the jacket copy. But I wanted to, I've been thinking a lot about my motivation in creating her, besides the sort of moment of inspiration, and what might have inspired me to create this character who maybe changes the course of history. And I love that idea of one person sort of having their hand on the lever of history, and one remarkable person being able to change the course of history. And I think that may have to do with the fact that I was really frustrated when I was in Tunisia. My sort of larger mission as a Rotary ambassadorial scholar was to create cultural understanding between the United States and the Arab world, and that was a really, really difficult task. It continues to be a really difficult task, but it was particularly difficult at that time, right, because it was right after the United States had invaded Iraq. And so I felt sort of continuously thwarted in my mission. And I felt a little bit depressed almost that, you know, I wasn't able to affect the change that I wanted to see in the world. And so I think maybe for that reason I created this character who would be able to change the course of history.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael David Lucas about his wonderful historical, fabulous novel, The Oracle of Stamboul. You know, it's so interesting what you've just said, because here you have Tunisia, which in fact in some ways was, the course of history was changed by one person. You know, it was somebody who set himself afire in a kind of sacrifice and lit the imagination of a nation.
Yeah, I love the idea of one person being able to change history, but it's also pretty phenomenal that, you know, a group of people can change history, that a group of people coming out on the streets in Tunisia or Egypt or Bahrain or wherever can topple a regime like that, and it makes you realize, you know, how much power we do all have.
You teach writing to fourth and fifth graders, is that right?
Third, fourth, and fifth graders, yeah.
Third, fourth, and so how do you get them kind of inspired? Are some of the things that you learned in writing this book things that you transmit to your own students?
Yeah, there is not that much to teach to young writers. They're really natural writers, young people. They have these amazing, fertile imaginations and a kind of innate sense of plot. And they don't second-guess themselves in the way that adult writers do. So, you know, you'll get these stories that are really wacky. Like, one little girl wrote a novel. We were writing novels as a part of National Novel Writing Month. One little girl wrote a novel about a tooth fairy, a ghost tooth fairy, who is the tooth fairy of ghost dogs and was his own worst enemy. And these other two girls wrote a novel in alternating points of view about a moldy cucumber and a moldy pickle who are best friends, and they're trying to escape the refrigerator, but they keep being thwarted by this bottle of Hershey's cocoa. And how amazing is that? An adult writer would just second guess that immediately, but they just roll with it, and they come up with some really phenomenal stuff. So I teach them the basics of writing, and I sort of teach them about the plot arc and characters and things like that. But really, I'm just giving names to things that they know already.
My granddaughter is turning 7, and she's just gotten very interested in writing stories. And I kind of watched the same thing myself. I was quite surprised. You know, I thought I was going to have to teach her that you had to have conflict in a story, you know, something exciting happened. And I watched how she set the characters, she set the place, she set the time, and, you know, they were kind of having a party, and it wasn't really all that interesting. And she said to me, something's got to happen. we've got to have something. Oh, she said, I know, I'll have some lions that will come and, you know, eat people. And I thought, she got it. You know, she knows you have to have some conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and they love reading. That's the other thing that just amazed me. You know, I'll read publishing blogs or whatever, and there's so much sort of doom and gloom about the publishing industry, which may be warranted, you know, but you see these young kids, and they love reading, and they love physical books, and it just makes you sort of hopeful for the future.
Yeah, hopefully they'll keep that. Now, speaking of loving reading, that's one of the features of your character, Eleanora Cohen. I wanted to ask you, why did you make her Jewish within this context? Is there something about the outsider there, or is there another reason?
It's almost like a non-reason. I'm Jewish, and to me, she was always Jewish. It just always kind of made sense. Once she was Jewish, and she kind of always was, and I definitely did have to grapple, though, with the role of Jews in the Ottoman Empire and the role of non-Muslim, of Christians in the Ottoman Empire and the role of Muslims in the Christian areas of the Ottoman Empire. You know, there was certainly a lot of ethnic conflict in that time and place, but there was also, you know, it was also a place that was sort of typified by its multi-ethnic nature, and people got along in large part. So I wanted to show how people did get along and how people did live alongside each other, but at the same time, I wanted to also give voice to the very real sort of ethnic tensions and the violence that comes later on in the empire.
Right. And in fact, I'd always thought that the Ottoman Empire kind of ended around World War I, you know, and kind of the whole Armenian genocide that occurred around that time. But you're pegging it a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit earlier than that. There's the what's called the Hamidian Massacres, which takes place in the early 1890s. And so that takes place after the end of the book.
And what were those?
It was kind of the dress rehearsal for the Armenian genocide is a way that a lot of historians put it. You know, they were sort of these loosely organized massacres of Armenian villagers in eastern, what's now eastern Turkey. And, you know, reprisals from the Armenian villagers against the Muslims living in that area. So it was just some really horrible ethnic violence.
And there was also an awful lot of intrigue, of course. You had, in the book, The Oracle of Stamboul, you have some central plot points in a political standoff between the Ottoman Empire, Russia, and Germany. Did this actually happen?
No, it didn't. I totally made it up. I'm glad someone asked me. But no, it didn't happen. As I said to a blogger who was sort of trying to pin me down about the historical accuracy, I can't vouch for the historical accuracy of anything past Chapter 8. And that particular standoff did not happen, but it very well could have. There were a lot of tensions, particularly between the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and Germany at the end of the Ottoman Empire sort of took this caretaker role. And, you know, Wilhelm II, who was the emperor, I think, of the German Empire, was pretty friendly with Abdulhamid II and sent a lot of military advisors over there. And he was trying to, you know, he had his own sort of designs for the Middle East, but there was definitely, it was that sort of great game before World War I where everyone was jockeying for position and everyone sort of wanted a piece of what they thought was going to come of the Ottoman Empire.
So they were already seeing it fall, basically.
Yeah, there was, you know, people were talking about it falling for a long, long time, and it was beginning to shed certain outer provinces, or what would be thought of as outer provinces. You know, like there was the Greek Revolution, then there was Bosnia was given over to the Habsburgs, and, you know, so there was all these sort of provinces that were outside of the core of the Anatolian heartland that were being shed.
And you mentioned Sultan Abdulhamid II. You present him as a kind of forward-thinking, modern ruler, somebody who, you know, was more of the coming Turkish, you know, what happened to Turkey, rather than what was already going away. Is that true as well?
It was really hard to present Abdulhamid II, in part because he was a sultan, and I've never been a sultan, so I don't know what that's like. And that feels very, very different from my reality. And also in part because I know, you know, something about the historical Abdulhamid II. And the historical Abdulhamid II wasn't really a great guy. And he's a very, very controversial figure in Turkey. One of my professors at Brown University actually was a political prisoner for a while because of his writings about Abdulhamid II.
Wow, why?
You know, he was the last major sultan of the Ottoman Empire, and so he represents this old order. And the Islamists aren't really excited about him because he sort of represents the secularizing tendency, and the secularists who, you know, love Ataturk aren't really into him because he was what came before Ataturk and what Ataturk was trying to reform. And so no one is really excited about Osman II unless there are some, you know, Ottoman revivalists in Turkey, which I doubt there are too many of them.
Now, so this was your first novel. What were some of the biggest challenges for you in writing this?
You know, there were the challenges. I wrote 7 drafts, and with each draft, I threw out the previous one. Didn't really throw it out. You know, I put it on a file on my computer, but I started from scratch. And so that was painful to do.
I'll bet.
I think the end product was better for it. So there was that sort of, and, you know, the first 3 drafts, I was really teaching myself how to write a novel. And then the last 3 or 4 drafts, I was actually doing it and working through the characters and the plot and things like that. So there was that challenge of the writing. And then there was the challenge of, you know, living the rest of my life and supporting myself. And I was lucky to get that Rotary scholarship, and I did an MFA program for 2 years, and I did a Fulbright in Turkey for a year. But then there was a couple of years in there where I didn't have any fellowships or grants or anything like that. And so it was sort of a challenge of working a full-time job and writing at the same time.
And was it difficult to get interest in this book as an unknown writer, of a novelist? I mean, novels are even more difficult, generally.
It worked out really well for me, but it was definitely one of the most nervous periods of my life. Once I got my agent, I was pretty sure that things were going to work out because she's really phenomenal. But I was very nervous throughout the whole process.
And how did you find her?
When I finished the book, I sort of contacted everybody who I knew who had any connection with publishing, and I asked them to send me a list of agents who they thought were good. And I got a list of maybe 30 different agents. The woman who would become my agent, Nicole Araji, kept showing up on the top of everybody's list. And so I got an introduction to her through my old boss at a literary magazine, and I sent the manuscript to her. Actually, she's the only person who I sent a physical manuscript to, and I like that she didn't want an email manuscript. I like that she wanted me to send her an actual paper manuscript, even though it cost me like $40. But it worked out in the end, you know, and as soon as she said that she wanted to represent me, I knew I was in good hands, and I sort of gave it all over to her.
Well, it is a terrific read, The Oracle of Stamboul, a novel, the debut novel of Michael David Lucas, who's been our guest here on Writer's Voice. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Michael David Lucas has written for Slate, National Geographic Traveler, and Georgia Review. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Oracle of Stamboul. You can also hear the author read the book's first chapter. Next up, we talk with Triti Umrugar about her latest novel, The World We Found. Don't go away. Back to Writer's Voice, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We first spoke with Indian-born writer Triti Umrugar in 2009 about her novel The Weight of Heaven. It's a story of an American couple who go to India to try to forget the tragic death of their young son. Umrugar's new novel, The World We Found, is also set in her native land. This time, the focus is on four women from Bombay who were the closest of friends as idealistic students in the turbulent 1970s. Over the years, the four, Armaiti, Kavita, Lala, and Nishta, have drifted apart. But they're suddenly pulled together again when Armaiti, who's been living in America, finds out that she has terminal cancer. She wants her friends to come together to visit her in America so that she can see them one last time.
When we meet them in the course of the novel, they are in their late 40s. But then there are, through a series of flashbacks, we learn a little bit about them in their college days when they were young student activists and radicals in the Bombay of the late 1970s.
The novel opens actually with Lale, who's just received a letter from Armaiti, who is went to the U.S. after she graduated. She's sick with cancer, and she wants her friends to come and visit her. If you could just give us a little synopsis of each character, maybe starting with Lale.
Lale is somebody who is in a very happy marriage. She lives in Bombay, and she's married to a man who was also part of their little group in college. So they are like college sweethearts. And she basically has a very comfortable, very affluent lifestyle, but is forever measuring what she considers to be, I suppose, the vacantness of her life today with the headiness of their time in college. So she's a bit disgruntled between the gap between, you know, the people they were, the world that they had wanted to be part of, and the world that she finds herself in. Kavita is also living in Bombay. She's a successful architect, and she is gay, and she has always secretly harbored this crush on Armaiti, which she has never told her about. And so when she has an opportunity to travel to America to meet her, one of the things that she's grappling with is whether to let, you know, past love stay hidden in the shadows or whether to say something, acknowledge that. To the others. Armaiti herself is, she has moved to the U.S., you know, soon after graduating from college in Bombay in the 70s, and is now divorced. She has a college-age daughter, Diane, and basically, you know, has a rich and happy life until she gets the diagnosis of the brain tumor. And this arouses in her a great desire to be reunited with the other three. And the final character is Nishta, or Zoha. She has two names, and I'll explain why. Nishta is a Hindu woman who married her college sweetheart, who was Muslim, Iqbal, after graduation. And over the course of the novel, one of the things that we learn and one of the things that the plot hinges upon is the fact that Iqbal, more than any of the other five, has really moved away from his radical past and is now a conservative Muslim. And he insists that she take the Muslim name Zoha. And when the others find her after years of absence, they are shocked to discover that Nishta is now living this very constricted kind of life.
Yeah, that's a wonderful roundup of them. You know, through those characters, not just the four main characters, but also the people connected to them, you're exploring a number of different issues which have to do with how things have changed in India and also how things are still changing. I wonder if we could go back to the time of their youth, that idealistic time. Say a little bit about what was going on there. What was that India, and what is so different about it now?
Well, in a nutshell, what's so different about it now is globalization, you know, which has affected everybody in up to varying degrees, I would say. several of them feel like the promise of globalization has not been realized, which is paradoxical because most of these characters are, with the notable exception of Iqbal and Nishtha, the other three or the other two women who are in India clearly are sort of affluent and they've done well for themselves and have actually benefited from the winds of change, have benefited from globalization. But since they all still have a social conscience, it's not enough for them to have benefited personally. When they look at sort of the world around them or the country around them, they feel like the 70s were a time of promise, a time when the country seemed poised on some kind of change, and when they sincerely, as young people often do, believed that through hard work they could be part of that change, that they could create a better country. And Lale especially seems particularly jaundiced by the reality that she confronts in present time. She doesn't think, you know, there's a line in the book that says something like, so we've built half a dozen more malls, so what? What does that change? And what she means by that, I think, is how does that really affect the daily reality of people who don't even have the money to enter the mall, let alone buy something there?
Yeah, and that spirit of idealism, their connection, all four of them back when they were in university, got pretty violently torn apart by the Hindu-Muslim violence that came after. For those of our listeners, and I'm sure there are many of them who don't really know much about what happened, could you talk about that?
Yeah, in a nutshell, Bombayites sort of considered themselves to be living in a kind of certainly not paradise, but what do I want to say? In a city that had largely escaped the kind of religious and communal strife that has so torn apart the rest of the country. They saw it as a kind of safe spot, if you will, until the riots of 1992-93, where Hindus and Muslims simply butchered each other on the streets. And especially for middle-class people who had been protected from that degree of naked violence up to that point. You know, I guess if you're living in the slums, you're much more likely to run into that kind of stuff than if you're living in a high-rise. And there was something about those riots that profoundly changed the way middle-class Bombayites saw their city ever after. And we can trace what happens to Iqbal, who goes from this very secular, very carefree kind of a young man to becoming this rather stern, conservative man who believes that there's safety in numbers. We can certainly trace his path to those riots because not only do they affect him in a global or political sense with the city being on fire, but it also happens to have some very personal ramifications within his own family.
So this is something he really... What happens to him, what happens to his family, is something that he really takes very personally. I mean, it destroys his sense of safety, as you say. And yet the very person that it happens to doesn't have the same take on it that he does.
Yes. And, I mean, it's hard to answer why. Part of it is just the quirks of individual personality, right? We know this in our own lives, that the same horrific events can happen, you know, to several people, and they will all become slightly different people because of it, and they will respond to or react to that incident or events in a different way. So some of it is just that there's a difference between him and the other member of his family. But part of it is also that, you know, all said and done, Iqbal is male, and he is part of a community, he's part of a culture that puts certain responsibilities upon males. And he feels that his job is to be protector and defender of family honor, of the female members of his family. You know, no matter how enlightened, politically speaking, he might be in other ways, there is still this sort of ancient burden that's on his shoulders. And this, in turn, makes him feel like what has happened to this other member of the family, in a sense, has happened to him.
We're talking with Thriti Umrugar about her latest novel, The World We Found. Yeah, It's interesting that in the marriage between Nishtha and Iqbal, that it's actually started out as an enlightened act. You know, it was an act here. There was a Hindu woman and a Muslim man who come together again, in spite of the religious bigotry of Nishtha's family, at the very least, if not Iqbal's.
Right, right, absolutely. Yeah, they were the golden couple. You know, they were the promise. You asked me earlier, you know, to talk a little bit about sort of the years when they were in college, and the rest of them looked at Nishtha and Iqbal as citizens of a brave new world. I mean, these were the pathblazers, right? This is what they had all aspired to, a country where, you know, old divisions of caste and religion just would play no role. And the irony is, I'm not even convinced that it's necessarily, you know, religion that separates them or breaks them apart as a couple. I think it's much more sort of the ideological changes that Iqbal goes through. Not to mention the fact that they don't have a lot of money, you know, and the kind of pressures that low-grade poverty, if you will, puts on a couple. It's just all those things. It's social custom. It's all those things that act as wedges between them. But mostly it's the fact that Iqbal changes so dramatically.
And is it also because Iqbal's family is Muslim that they're poor?
Well, yes and no, but clearly there are references in the book that talk about the fact that he has faced discrimination in his workplace. He used to work at a bank. And actually, you know, the slight irony here is that as long as his boss at the bank was convinced that he was married to another Muslim, he was treated just fine. But when he finds out that Iqbal is part of an inner religious marriage, that Nishtha was born Hindu, that's when he turns against Iqbal to the point where Iqbal finally hands in his resignation and then, you know, makes a disastrous career choice after that. So again, it's that fine balance, you know. It's hard to know how much of it is circumstance and how much of it is sort of the role of the individual in making poor circumstances worse.
Yeah, and another thing that struck me was Armaiti. There's a scene where Armaiti is talking with her daughter Diane about Iqbal. That's a very powerful scene. There's a passage on 115. So set us up here, tell us what's going on, and then read that section. That would be great.
Okay, so here's a scene where Armaiti has just gotten off the phone, and she's found out that Iqbal is point-blank refusing to let Nishtha travel to America. And she's very frustrated, and she makes some disparaging comment about him being a religious bigot. And her daughter, Diane, to whom she's speaking, kind of questions that kind of what she sees as her mom being extremely judgmental. And you see here not just a generation gap, but also a huge cultural gap between the daughter's understanding of the world and the mother's. So here's the section. So why did she feel like she and her daughter were not speaking the same language? That there was something simplistic, even childlike, about her daughter's understanding of the world? That right now, Diane seemed more like Richard's daughter, good-hearted, well-meaning Richard, whose American innocence had always felt endearing and dangerous to her than her own. That the Diane who was looking at her with a slight frown on her face was truly the child of the American Midwest, sweet but bland, with not a trace of her mother's heritage of spice and vinegar. And you, Armaiti asked herself, what language do you speak? A dead language, the language of a faraway time, of a world that no longer exists, of a time when they had believed the prophet who claimed that religion was the opiate of the masses. They had not seen religion as a polite, innocuous, private issue, as Diane did, or a topic for cocktail party conversations. Not for them the benign New Age, crystals and angels view of religion shared by so many of her American friends. She and the others had seen religion as a ferocious beast to be tamed, as a weapon that the ruling class used to keep the masses in servitude, or a demon genie that the politicians let out of the bottle every time there was an election to be won.
I mean, religion, of course, has become a pretty flaming issue on the horizon these days. I mean, the whole issue of fundamentalism has flared so much. This passage says so much about contemporary issues, but also the way things used to be, and also about deracination. I wonder if you could unpack this a little bit for us.
Well, first of all, to tackle the simplest point, I completely agree with you. I mean, there are, you know, one of the things I always hope, many of my books are set in India. They are set in very specific locales. But my greatest hope and desire as a writer, needless to say, is that they have some kind of universal application, you know. And I never feel that I'm writing, even if I'm writing something about a slum in Bombay, you know, there are slums elsewhere in the world, too. There's the inner city in the United States. One of my books, The Space Between Us, which tells the story really quickly of a domestic servant and her quote-unquote mistress, the woman that she works for. You know, I think that book could easily be set in the American South from 50 years ago, you know, with black and white. So, absolutely, I mean, there seems to be a kind of religious fundamentalism that's sweeping across the globe, and you know, people much smarter than me who really study this issue will argue that in some sense it's a backlash to globalization, which, you know, is empowering and making rich many, many people, but is also leaving such destruction in its path that this is something that people have to cling to. And I don't mean to sound like President Obama here, because he certainly got a lot of flack, if you recall, during 2008 for talking about people clinging to religion and guns. But I don't think you're insulting somebody by saying that when civic society fails you, as it does in the case of Iqbal, that the thing that people turn to for solace is religion. And sad to say that often it's a very rigid, you know, oppressive, narrowly defined kind of religion.
We're speaking with Thriti Umargar about her latest novel, The World We Found. Another change, or you could almost say some of the winners of globalization, are women. And there's this book kind of chronicles a great shift in the position of women in Indian society. One could say maybe with the exception of Nishtha, who goes through her own reverse kind of shift from a greater freedom to lesser freedom. But the others have much greater freedom, one would imagine, than their mothers.
You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is, nobody knows for sure. I mean, yes, clearly amongst middle-class women there is slightly more occupational mobility, which hopefully translates into a kind of social mobility that gives them more power within marriages, within the home. But the fact is, until and unless you count every woman who is adversely affected by globalization, you know, who is left behind, so to speak, one doesn't really know. I mean, for every Lale and every Kavita, there is also a Nishtha, who you could argue in some ways is a victim, not so much of globalization, but you know, clearly she has taken a few steps back in her life. So yes, on one hand, it has benefited, you know, it has sort of contributed to the rise of the great Indian middle class. But it's also left a lot of people behind.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about yourself. Did you grow up in Bombay or around that area?
I grew up in Bombay, yes.
Which is now known as Mumbai.
Mumbai, I was just going to say. Yeah, I guess I'm dating myself by calling it Bombay. But I just, you know, for me, it's forever Bombay, I guess.
Yeah. Do you feel kind of nostalgia for the old Bombay?
I'll tell you what I feel nostalgia for, and I say this with a hint of self-consciousness, because I realize that I'm describing a very, very narrow slice of life in what I'm about to say. But I believe that the Bombay that I grew up in was really a pretty secular, intellectually rich place. And I guess, you know, given the forces of religious fundamentalism that seem to be blowing everywhere that you look, I miss that. I miss the hopefulness of the late 70s, which was sort of my period, you know. And of course, I'm nostalgic for certain aspects of it, but they may not be the aspects that will make a lot of sense to most people. I mean, what I so admire about that city is the fortitude of its citizens, and I'm mostly talking about sort of the poor people, you know. There is a kind of joyfulness in which they face everyday life under the bleakest, harshest circumstances that you can imagine. And there's a kind of sweetness that veers on a kind of innocence that people there have. And I am filled with admiration every time I visit there. And I just think, how do you do it? I mean, how is it the city with such grave inequality is not just blowing up every single day? And life really just goes on.
Hmm. Were you there during the Muslim-Hindu riots?
No, and that's something I did want to say, you know, when I started by talking about, you know, the fact that this affected people so very much. I had already left for the U.S. almost a good 10 years prior to that, and yet just, you know, my family was still there, and I would hear the stories that I could scarcely believe on the phone, and it had such a deep, visceral impact on me, just listening to the tales, that I can't even imagine what kind of a reaction I would have had if I was actually witnessing what so many people did, which is seeing entire buildings go up in flames. I can't imagine how that would have affected me, because it affected me deeply enough just hearing secondhand the stories of what was going on.
And
it was the end of a dream, you know. It truly felt like the end of an era and the end of innocence in some ways.
Is there any kind of connection between, you know, on the one hand, you talk about, you know, that amazing fortitude and sweetness and, you know, endurance that people have, and then things flame into this kind of violence. Is there a total disconnect, or is that violence something that is just always just beneath the surface, or was it something that was, in fact, you know, exploited or promoted?
Oh, shamelessly exploited and shamelessly manipulated. I mean, much like what we see here with elections, you know. I mean, just preying upon people's worst fears about each other. And in India, you have the compounding reality of the fact that, you know, for all practical purposes, it's still a country and a city, Bombay, with a lot of undereducated or ill-educated or simply non-educated, uneducated people. And so, you know, it's not like somebody can fire up their home computer and go to Google and find the truth about what the politicians are saying. They don't have the means of independent self-discovery. So very often it's rumor and those kinds of things that just prey upon people. And absolutely, a lot of these events are completely manufactured. You know, it is the basest kind of appeal to irrational human behavior.
Yeah. And we are talking with Thriti Umrugar. And let's go back to your wonderful novel, The World We Found. Just as a last thing I wanted to observe about it and have you talk about, it's almost as if we're talking about Armaiti here, who has a brain tumor, and she's asked her friends to come to America, you know, to get together almost for the first time in 30 years. It's almost as if her illness liberates in different ways each of her three friends. Is that true?
Yes, I mean, I think the ultimate result is one of liberation, but I think the bulk of the novel deals with the process that leads to that degree of liberation. Towards the very end of the novel, Nishtha actually has a line where she says something like she has used Armaiti's illness as a ladder to climb out of the dark pit of her own life. And although hers is the most dramatic example of that, I think the other two, Kavita with harboring the secret of having had this huge crush on Armaiti all these years and never, you know, never admitting that she's gay to her dearest friends. And Lale, of course, harboring a lot of guilt over what she thinks was her betrayal of Armaiti 30 years ago. It forces all of them to confront things that perhaps they would have chosen not to in any other circumstances.
Well, it is just a wonderful book. I can recommend it to all our listeners. The World We Found. Thank you so much, Thriti Umrugar, for speaking with us here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so very much for having me.
Thriti Umrugar is the author of several novels, including Bombay Time and The Space Between Us, and the memoir First Darling of the Morning. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The World We Found.
If there ever was a time to move me now, is all I'm saying. If there ever was a time to get on your feet, you take it to the street. Cause you're the one that's getting played right now by the game they're playing. Come on, meet me down, it's a card park. And say, oh, where are the you?
We have a little time left, so I'd like to tell you about a new book of poetry to emerge from the Occupy movement. It's titled Liberty's Vigil, the Occupy Anthology, 99 Poets Among the 99%. The word liberty in the title could be seen as a double entendre. Zuccotti Park, the Manhattan site Occupy Wall Street held for 3 months before being forcibly expelled by Mayor Bloomberg, was known as Liberty Square before being taken over by a private developer. The occupiers, of course, reverted to the site's original name. Here's one of my favorite poems from the book, Occupation of the Heart, by John Richard Smith. It's not a protest or a demonstration, but an occupation. And whoever occupies the heart sleeps on stone in the absent shadows of two thrones. How effortlessly the moon slips in and out of phases. Not so the heart. Not so its occupation, which demands the strength it takes to birth a nation. In the cold fall rain, the heart pitches its makeshift tent at the foot of a Goliath wall, its only arms a single drum, but it is one among many. Listen, you can hear the summons beating its wings against your ribcage. That was Occupation of the Heart by John Richard Smith. And here's another, World Conditions Are Such, by Leah Zazulier. World conditions are such that trees are resisting the draft, refusing to volunteer their blossom for a uniform green. Yes, I know they've come out, arms up, and the wind whips them in a foreign tongue. But I tell you, they will never surrender, not one dogwood, lilac, or quince, until its last drop of bud. Those were poems from the new book, Liberty's Vigil, The Occupy Anthology. It's edited by Carla Lynn Merrifield and Dwayne Wilder. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.